So most of us do it. We overthink things, and that opens the floodgates of worrying thoughts that seemingly cannot be stopped. Unchecked overthinking can lead to anxiety and a cascade of physical problems too, things like ulcers. Well, Dr. Gwendolyn Smith is an Auckland psychologist who sees several patients a day, about seven on average, and she says four of the seven grapple with worrisome overthinking. She offers tools to blame the blitz, to tame the blitz of thoughts in her latest publication. It's called The Book of Overthinking. I'll get to her in a moment. I just wanted to confirm to you what we announced earlier, that the Prime Minister has announced the 19th of September as the election date this year. We'll be voting on the 19th of September. She's just announced that in her post Cabinet press conference. We'll have more online and in the 4pm news. Well, Dr. Gwendolyn Smith is with us now. Hello there.
Hi, Jesse. Nice to see you again.
Overthinking can be positive, right? If you're nutting away at something, working out a problem, when does it tip into something that you should be concerned about?
Good question, because I spent a lot of time at the beginning of the book separating. Because people will go, well, not all overthinking is negative. You know, like I think about, you know, a project that I'm working on and, you know, I'm not bothered about it. But when people start to overthink in a more negative manner, and by that, what I refer to is that the thinking, Jesse, becomes what if, what if, what if, what if. And so the theme of the thinking is what if this catastrophically bad thing happens. So that's the theme of worrisome overthinking. Nine times out of ten, the thought content is going to start with, yeah, but what if? And then that's the type of overthinking that starts to interfere with health.
Well, what are some of the consequences of thinking too much?
The first thing it's going to attack, Jesse, is sleep. Now, all of the mental health conditions have a relationship with sleep. That's why there's been so much emphasis put on it now. Because you see now, just to digress for a second, with younger people with screen addiction, the first thing that's going is sleep. With schizophrenia, you will see a sleep disturbance before an episode. With bipolar disorder, you'll see no need for sleep prior to mania. Depression, people tend to oversleep or wake up in a black hole at 4 a.m. Now, with worrisome overthinking, it's people will hit the pillow, they might go off to sleep quite quickly because they're exhausted, but then every couple of 3 hours, they're waking up and worrying about the subject or overthinking the subject, if you like. So the sleep is never refreshing. Nobody wakes up thinking, yay, boy, batteries are recharged. What a fabulous night's sleep that was. They wake up, they're burnt out, they're exhausted, it will affect mood. And I'm a great believer now, Jesse. I actually don't work because one of my books was on depression. I don't really work with it now because I see anxiety as the epidemic and I see depression as when the battery goes flat. And high-functioning people or people with a lot to do, they're going to keep going. You know, it's like that Caudrell Ford ad, soldier on, soldier on. And so they keep going and keep going and they're running on empty. No sleep, it's not refreshing, running on empty, and then slowly but surely the battery goes flat. And that's when you start to see that neurological pathway into depression. So depression is actually the burnout of the system that then takes you down that neurological pathway. It's very rarely, there's some genetic exceptions. There would be post-traumatic stress disorder exceptions like the terrible tragedy in Christchurch. But that's different. People will sink into depression quite quickly because it's post-trauma. But the bulk of depression that you see is the outcome of this endless, endless, endless anxiety fueled by non-constructive overthinking.
So what is the connection between worrisome overthinking and anxiety? Is it the fuel you describe it as? So the anxiety exists and you are making it worse by lying there and going over these things over and over again?
Yeah. One of the things that the cognitive science explains really clearly is that how you are thinking will switch on your physiological response, e.g. fight flight, your emotional response, and how you're thinking also dictates what you're going to do. Okay, so the thinking is the headquarters, and that masterminds, for want of a better word, that masterminds what all the other stuff is going to do. And so we've already talked about sleep disturbance. If you see, the theme of this catastrophic thinking is always negative.
Mm-hmm.
The filter on the world is always negative. So it's not like, wow, I am so looking forward to tomorrow because I am just sure there's going to be a huge surprise
Let me replay what a great day I had a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, So the filter's always negative.
Yeah.
And you see, that's how it runs amok.
And also dominated by beliefs rather than facts, right?
Yeah. Well, you remember, or maybe you don't, because you and I both talk to a lot of people, but I always make a big deal to talk about the fact that feelings are not facts, that people run away with a feeling as if it's telling them the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Feelings are not telling you the truth. They are a reflection only of what you're thinking. So then if you go back to the cognitive process, which is the thinking, like I might say to someone, here's a cute example, Jesse, this will work. So I'll stand in front of a client and I'll say, hey, I said, you reckon the world's flat or round? And they look at me as if I'm a bit demented and say, well, of course it's round. And I said, well, I'm standing on it, love. It feels flat to me. I'm touching it with my hands. It's definitely flat. Feels flat, looks flat. I believe it's flat. Well, you and I both know it's not flat. But the thing is, I'm believing something based on how it feels, and I'm not taking in the fact that why I'm standing up is because of all sorts of forces like gravity for one, you know, like all these things. So when I look at the facts, the world is round. But people go, oh, yeah, well, I believe that such and such, so it must be fact. No. Oh, well, I felt that when I walked into the room, I really felt that other people had been talking about me before I got into the room. How do you know that? Well, I don't actually know it, but you know how you get a gut feeling? No. Feelings are not facts either.
Is it useful to I've seen it described as the brain getting hijacked by thoughts. Is that a useful metaphor, overthinking?
Yep. It is called the amygdala hijack, Jesse. And what it is that, and I've talked in the book of overthinking, which I didn't do in the book of knowing, I've talked about the genetics of anxiety. Now, if you've got a hypersensitivity in the limbic system, you're hypersensitive to everything. Noise, smell, feelings, everything. So what happens is that, say, someone says something to you like, oh, get over yourself, and that reminds you perhaps of your father having said that to you when you were growing up, that will then trigger the emotional memory of how you felt as a child when dad was putting you down. So therefore, the response that you have in the here and now when someone says that goes backwards, collects the memory in the amygdala, which then, and this is how it works, Jesse, which then hijacks the ability to rationally think. Because the amygdala is where the fight-flight mechanism is. And once that's switched on, bang, all we're prepared to do is run, jump, attack, fight, flight, freeze. So therefore, the oxygen that would be used to keep the temporal lobe, tickety-boo, thinking rationally, has now gone to the extremities. So the temporal lobe is hijacked. That's what that means.
Do you ever meet patients who are worried, who are afraid not to worry, who feel that worrying is part of the process, that the worrying helps to make everything work out?
Yeah. Two answers to that one. One is, Jesse, you would have heard of that phrase meta-analysis. You know, when you do an analysis and then you do a meta-analysis of the analysis of the analysis. Chronic worriers do that.
Mm.
So if I'm sort of working away with the therapeutic techniques and stuff that are in the book and the worry's responding quite nicely, they're managing it really well, and then all of a sudden I get, I'll say, how's your week been? Actually quite good. You know, I can honestly say, you know, worrying's right down. But what I'm thinking is if the worrying goes completely, I mean, if I did stop worrying, I just can't see how that's going to work, because how am I going to, A, here's the mythology, how am I going to, A, prevent bad things from happening, and B, am I going to lose the edge on predicting bad things coming my way? So, but you see, that stuff's just superstitious bullshit, excuse me, the language on the radio in New Zealand, but you know what I mean? I can't make the point strong enough, Jesse, because worry is superstitious behaviour. It has no power to prevent. It has no power to predict. The only power it has is to give you a restless night's sleep and on a bad day, irritable bowel syndrome. It has no power whatsoever. I mean, it's as ridiculous as me saying, and there's a cute little cartoon about this, but say, for instance, because I saw you about this time last year, and I come in and you say to me, so, Gwendolyn, hi, you know, how you doing? And I went, good. Touch wood. Now, what does that mean? What does that actually mean? You know, I'm banging on a hopefully wooden table. Then I bang on my head, so therefore the inference is that my head could be made of wood, but we know it isn't. But it's superstitious behaviour, and that's all worry is. It has no validity in the real world.
I'm speaking with Dr. Gwendolyn Smith, who has a new book called The Book of Overthinking. Is all worry created equally? We're told not to sweat the small stuff. Is it just as dangerous worrying about whether you've got cancer as, well, why hasn't that person replied to my Facebook message? It's been almost half a day. You know, is all that stuff the same sort of problem?
The thing is, Jesse, is that the membership of the anxiety family, as I call it, is quite a big membership. You've got the fear of negative evaluation, which we've talked about before. You've got OCD. You've got post-traumatic. You've got health anxiety. You've got worry, which is called generalized anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. You've got the eating disorders, and so it goes on. So with health anxiety, and in my mind, they're all linked. If you're anorexic, you're worrying about your body size and how much you're eating. If you've got OCD, you're worrying about contamination and symmetry and those sorts of things. Fear of negative evaluation, you're worrying about being judged by other people. Health anxiety used to be called hypochondria. Remember that term? So that's the replacement term for it now. And what that is, it's about worrying about health. So say, for instance, someone with health anxiety looks down at their arm after a summer frolicking around on the beach and notices a freckle. And then all of a sudden, looking at the freckle, straight onto Dr. Google, looking it up, then goes in melanomas, research, skin cancer overall research. Then we've got to have the appointment with the doctor, and then we may have made an appointment with MoleMap. So therefore, the constant attentional focus is on things to do with health and worrying about health. Does that answer that?
Same old stuff, though, just a different subject matter.
Yeah.
We better get to this. How do you change your thinking? Where do you start?
Okay, well, this one, like the last book, was based in the fundamental sciences of cognitive behavioural therapy. The essence of that science is not to positive think. It's not about positive affirmations. It's not about replacing negative thoughts with positive thoughts. Like if I said to the listeners, for instance, hey, now while I'm Jesse and I are doing this interview, I don't want you to think about camels. I don't want you to visualize camels. I don't want you to see National Geographic covers. I don't want you to imagine David Attenborough in Egypt. I just want you to listen to what we're doing. So I think I can hear through the headphones the bulk of you have actually been thinking about camels. So therefore, it is not an adequate approach for someone to say, well, hey, look into the mirror, like yourself, be at one with the universe, you know, get just, you're beautiful, your soul is beautiful. I mean, people are negative thinking, you know, and worrying. I mean, that stuff's just rubbish. It's just nonsense. And I read this book when I was researching this one, and it was by a guy called Wegner, and it's called White Bears and Other Unwanted Thoughts. Because I could never work out why, when I said to people, now don't think about camels, obviously the response was people would think about camels. The reason why that happens is that the memory turns up in the middle of this dialogue. The memory turns up and goes, what? What did I miss? Don't think about what? What am I supposed to not think about? Oh, I'm not supposed to think about camels. That's why it doesn't work. So in cognitive science, what we do is take the thinking, look where the perception's distorted, and replace it with factually evidence-based rational processing. That's the guts.
What's the benefit of keeping what you call a thought record?
The thought diaries, mostly helpful. I mean, I use them when I'm seeing someone in therapy. I've stuck them in the book because the way the book's designed is for people that can't get access to therapy for financial reasons, mm-hmm. or they live in a, you know, region, that the last half of the book is like being in therapy with me. So you've got the thought records to practice with. Mm-hmm. And so you do need to know a little bit of the background before you would dive in to using a thought record. Because, sure, thought diaries, you know, people stream of consciousness writing, that's cool, and some people get a cathartic benefit from that, but you're not going to get the benefit that you get from reconstructing the way you think, so your thinking is more helpful.
You say that we need to get rid of the shoulds from our thinking. Can you explain that a bit?
Okay. Certain words, well, should, must, and have to, I see as sibling words. They basically mean the same thing. They put pressure on. They demand. Those words demand of other people. They cause guilt if you don't do something. They cause resentment if someone else doesn't do something that you think they should. And so when people say to me, well, you know, what am I going to stick in there to replace the word should? Because, of course, I'm so attuned to them, I can hear them, you know, rocking away. And I was like, okay, well, should, it's like your brow goes, you get all sort of pressured and wound up. I shouldn't have eaten that cake. I shouldn't have gone to that party. Whereas if you go, well, I did go to the party and I guess I could actually start the diet tomorrow. Can you hear it, Jesse? Just linguistically, I could rather than should.
Mm.
So the thing to remember is that thinking, our internal dialogue, that process is actually referred to as neuro-brain linguistics, the language of thought. And so when you've got this going on, it's all negative. That's you talking to you. And your mood and your well-being is going to be a function of what you're saying to yourself. And if you're constantly saying should, you're never really going to be able to just chill out.
Keep your thoughts descriptive rather than prescriptive. I should point out, by the way, the last time we were chatting, we were talking about kids, and kids overthinking is a growing issue. But this book is mostly geared for adults, right?
Yeah.
And any way that parents can take the book and maybe use it to help with their kids?
What I've done in the book, I think that the stuff on genetics and children learning to worry through role modelling parents, which is quite a big deal.
Mm.
So there's some interesting information on that. And then I've sort of wound into, okay, well, look, genetic predisposition is just that. You've got blue eyes, you've got green eyes. There's no point banging on about it. If there has been some role modelling going on and the kids have observed it and you're starting to watch them worry, again, don't start going, oh, I should have done this, I shouldn't have done that. What I have recommended in there is three or four of the books on worry for children, my favourites, and they are probably the best books on worry, well, apart from mine, the best books on worry that I've seen. Okay. So treating kids for worrying now is, you know, people know how to do it.
Dr. Gwendolyn Smith, congratulations on the book. Thanks for sharing a bit of it with us today.
Cheers, Jesse.
It's called The Book of Overthinking, How to Stop the Cycle of Worry.